Chapter 35. Retained by him, while the above were in type, for the purpose of revision, have been irrecoverably lost through the accident by which he perished himself. This, however, may prove not to be the case, and the papers, if ultimately found, will be given to the public. No means have been left untried to remedy the deficiency. The gentleman whose name is mentioned in the preface, and who, from the statement there made, might be supposed able to fill the vacuum, has declined the task this, for satisfactory reasons connected with the general inaccuracy of the details afforded him, and his disbelief in the entire truth of the latter portions of the narration. Peters, from whom some information might be expected, is still alive, and a resident of Illinois, but cannot be met with at present. He may hereafter be found, and will, no doubt, afford material for a conclusion of Mr. Pym's account. The loss of two or three final chapters, for there were but two or three, is the more deeply to be regretted, as it cannot be doubted they contained matter relative to the pole itself, or at least to regions, in its very near proximity. And as to the statements of the author in relation to these regions, may shortly be verified or contradicted by means of the governmental expedition now preparing for the Southern Ocean. On one point in the narrative some remarks may well be offered, and it would afford the writer of this appendix much pleasure, if what he may here observe, should have a tendency to throw credit, in any degree, upon the very singular pages now published. We allude to the chasms found in the island of Tsalal, and to the whole of the figures upon pages 245-47 of the printed edition ed. Mr. Pym has given the figures of the chasms without comment, and speaks decidedly of the indentures found at the extremity of the most easterly of these chasms as having but a fanciful resemblance to alphabetical characters, and, in short, as being positively not such. This assertion is made in a manner so simple, and sustained by a species of demonstration so conclusive, viz. The fitting of the projections of the fragments found among the dust into the indentures upon the wall, that we are forced to believe the writer in earnest, and no reasonable reader should suppose otherwise. But as the facts in relation to all the figures are most singular, especially when taken in connection with statements made in the body of the narrative, it may be as well to say a word or two concerning them all this too, the more especially as the facts in question have, beyond doubt, escaped the attention of Mr. Poe. Figure 1 then, Figure 2, Figure 3 and Figure 5, when conjoined with one another in the precise order which the chasms themselves presented, and when deprived of the small lateral branches or arches which, it will be remembered, served only as a means of communication between the main chambers, and were of totally distinct character, constitute an Ethiopian verbal root, the root image, obi shady, apostrophe whence all the inflections of shadow or darkness. In regard to the eftermost northwardly of the indentures in Figure 4, it is more than probable that the opinion of Peters was correct, and that the hieroglyphical appearance was really the work of art, and intended as the representation of a human form. The delineation is before the reader, and he may, or may not, perceive the resemblance suggested. But the rest of the indentures afford strong confirmation of Peter's idea. The upper range is evidently the Arabic verbal root image, T to be white, whence all the inflections of brilliancy and whiteness. The lower range is not so immediately perspicuous. The characters are somewhat broken and disjointed. Nevertheless, it cannot be doubted that, in their perfect state, they form the full Egyptian word image, T, the region of the south. Apostrophe apostrophe, it should be observed, that these interpretations confirm the opinion of Peters in regard to the us northwardly of the figures. The arm is outstretched toward the south. Conclusions such as these open a wide field for speculation and exciting conjecture. They should be regarded, perhaps, in connection with some of the most faintly detailed incidents of the narrative, although in no visible manner is this chain of connection complete. Tekelili was the cry of the affrighted natives of Tsalal upon discovering the carcass of the white animal picked up at sea. This also was the shuddering exclamatives of Tsalal upon discovering the carcass of the white materials in possession of Mr. Pym. This also was the shriek of the swift-flying, white, and gigantic birds which issued from the vapory white curtain of the south. Nothing white was to be found at Tsalal, and nothing otherwise in the subsequent voyage to the region beyond. It is not impossible that Tsalal, the appellation of the island of the chasms, may be found, upon minute philological scrutiny, to betray either some alliance with the chasms themselves, or some reference to the Ethiopian characters so mysteriously written in their windings. Have graven it within the hills, and my vengeance upon the dust within the rock. ... End of text. Chapter 25 Notes, asterisk 1, whaling vessels are usually fitted with iron oil tanks. Why the Grampus was not, I have never been able to ascertain. Asterisk 2, the case of the brig Polly, of Boston, is one so much in point, and her fate, in many respects, so remarkably similar to our own, that I cannot forbear alluding to it here. This vessel, of 130 tons burden, sailed from Boston, with a cargo of lumber and provisions, for Santa Croix, on the 12th of December, 1811, under the command of Captain Casno. There were 8 souls on board besides the captain, the mate, 4 seamen, and the cook, together with a Mr. Hunt, and a Negro girl belonging to him. On the 15th, having cleared the shoal of Georges, she sprung a leak in a gale of wind from the southeast, and was finally capsized. But, the masts going by the board, she afterward righted. They remained in this situation, without fire, and with very little provision, for the period of 191 days from December the 15th to June the 20th, when Captain Casno and Samuel Badger, the only survivors, were taken off the wreck by the Fame, of Hull, Captain Featherstone, bound home from Rio Janeiro. When picked up, they were in latitude 28 degrees N, longitude 13 degrees W, having drifted above 2,000 miles. On the 9th of July the Fame fell in with the brig Romero, Captain Perkins, who landed the 2 sufferers in Kennebec. The narrative from which we gather these details ends in the following words. "T is natural to inquire how they could float such a vast distance, upon the most frequented part of the Atlantic, and not be discovered all this time. They were passed by more than a dozen sail, one of which came so nigh them, that they could distinctly see the people on deck, and on the rigging looking at them. But, to the inexpressible disappointment of the starving and freezing men, they stifled the dictates of compassion, hoisted sail, and cruelly abandoned them to their fate." Asterisk 3, among the vessels which at various times have professed to meet with the Auroras may be mentioned the ship San Miguel, in 1769, the ship Aurora, in 1774, the brig Pearl, in 1779, and the ship Dolores, in 1790. They all agree in giving the mean latitude 53 degrees south. Asterisk 4, the terms morning and evening, which I have made use of to avoid confusion in my narrative, as far as possible, must not, of course, be taken in their ordinary sense. For a long time past we had had no night at all, the daylight being continual. The dates throughout are according to nautical time, and the bearing must be understood as per compass. I would also remark, in this place, that I cannot, in the first portion of what is here written, pretend to strict accuracy in respect to dates, or latitudes and longitudes, having kept no regular journal until after the period, of which this first portion treats. In many instances I have relied altogether upon memory. Asterisk 5, this day was rendered remarkable by our observing in the south several huge reefs of the grayish vapor I have spoken of. Asterisk 6, the marl was also black. Indeed, we noticed no light-colored substances of any kind upon the island. Asterisk 7, for obvious reasons I cannot pretend to strict accuracy in these dates. They are given principally with a view to perspicacity of narrative, and as set down in my pencil memorandum. Dot, tilde, 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 end of text, tilde, 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 narrative of A. Gordon Pym, equals, 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 Lygia, and the will therewith, which doth not. Who knoweth the mysteries of the will, with its vigor? For God is but a great will pervading all things by nature of its intentness. Man doth not yield himself to the angels, nor unto death utterly, save only through the weakness of his feeble will. Joseph Glanville. I cannot, for my soul, remember how, when, or even precisely where, I first became acquainted with the Lady Lygia. Long years have since elapsed, and my memory is feeble through much suffering. Or, perhaps, I cannot now bring these points to mind, because, in truth, the character of my beloved, her rare learning, her singular yet placid cast of beauty, and the thrilling and enthralling eloquence of her low musical language, made their way into my heart by paces so steadily and stealthily progressive, that they have been unnoticed and unknown. Yet I believe that I met her first and most frequently in some large, old, decaying city near the Rhine. Of her family I have surely heard her speak. That it is of a remotely ancient date cannot be doubted. Lygia. Lygia. In studies of a nature more than all else adapted to deaden impressions of the outward world, it is by that sweet word alone by Lygia that I bring before mine eyes in fancy the image of her who is no more. And now, while I write, a recollection flashes upon me that I have never known the paternal name of her who was my friend and my betrothed, and who became the partner of my studies, and finally the wife of my bosom. Was it a playful charge on the part of my Lygia, or was it a test of my strength of affection, that I should institute no inquiries upon this point, or was it rather a caprice of my own, a wildly romantic offering on the shrine of the most passionate devotion? I but indistinctly recall the fact itself. What wonder, that I have utterly forgotten the circumstances which originated or attended it. And, indeed, if ever she, the wan and the misty-winged Ashtophet of idolatrous Egypt, presided, as they tell, over marriages ill-omened, then most surely she presided over mine. There is one dear topic, however, on which my memory falls me not. It is the person of Lygia. In stature she was tall, somewhat slender, and, in her latter days, even emaciated. I would in vain attempt to portray the majesty, the quiet ease, of her demeanor, or the incomprehensible lightness and elasticity of her footfall. She came and departed as a shadow. I was never made aware of her entrance into my close study save by the dear music of her low sweet voice, as she placed her marble hand upon my shoulder. In beauty of face no maiden ever equaled her. It was the radiance of an opium dream, an airy, and spirit-lifting vision more wildly divine than the fantasies which hovered vision about the slumbering souls of the daughters of Delos. Yet her features were not of that regular mold which we have been falsely taught to worship in the classical labors of the heathen. There is no exquisite beauty, says Bacon, Lord Verulam, speaking truly of all the forms and genera of beauty, without some strangeness in the proportion. Yet, although I saw that the features of Lygia were not of a classic regularity, although I perceived that her loveliness was indeed exquisite, and felt that there was much of strangeness pervading it, yet I have tried in vain to detect the irregularity, and to trace home my own perception of the strange. I examined the contour of the lofty and pale forehead. It was faultless. How cold indeed that word, when applied to a majesty so divine, the skin rivaling the purest ivory, the commanding extent and repose, the gentle prominence of the regions above the temples, and then the raven black, the glossy, the luxuriant and naturally curling tresses, setting forth the full force of the Homeric epithet, hyacinthine. I looked at the delicate outlines of the nose, and nowhere but in the graceful medallions of the Hebrews had I beheld a similar perfection. There were the same luxurious smoothness of surface, the same scarcely perceptible tendency to the aquiline, the same harmoniously curved nostrils speaking the free spirit. I regarded the sweet mouth. Here was indeed the triumph of all things heavenly, the magnificent turn of the short upper lip, the soft, voluptuous slumber of the under, the dimples which sported, and the color which spoke, the teeth glancing back, with a brilliance I almost startling, every ray of the holy light which fell upon them in her serene and placid, yet most exultingly radiant of all smiles. I scrutinized the formation of the chin, and here too, I found the gentleness of breadth, the softness and the majesty, the fullness and the spirituality, of the Greek, the contour which the god Apollo revealed, but in a dream, to Cleomenes, the son of the Athenian. And then I peered into the large eaves of Lygia. For eyes we have no models in the remotely antique. It might have been too, that in these eaves of my beloved, lay the secret to which Lord Verulam alludes. They were, I must believe, far larger than the ordinary eyes of our own race. They were even fuller than the fullest of the gazelle eyes of the tribe of the valley of Nerjahid. Yet it was only at intervals, in moments of intense excitement, that this peculiarity became more than slightly noticeable in Lygia. And at such moments, was her beauty in my heated fancy thus it appeared perhaps the beauty of beings either above or apart from the earth, the beauty of the fabulous Auri of the Turk. The hue of the orbs was the most brilliant of black, and, far over them, hung jetty lashes of great length. The brows, slightly irregular in outline, had the same tint. The strangeness, however, which I found in the eyes, was of a nature distinct from the formation, or the color, or the brilliancy of the features, and must, after all, be referred to the expression. Ah, word of no meaning! Behind whose vast latitude of mere sound we entrench our ignorance of so much of the spiritual. The expression of the eyes of Lygia. How for long hours have I pondered upon it. How have I, through the whole of a midsummer night, struggled to fathom it? What was it, that something more profound than the will of Democritus which lay far within the pupils of my beloved? What was it? I was possessed with a passion to discover. Those eyes. Those large, those shining, those divine orbs. They became to me twin stars of Leda, and I to them devoutest of astrologers. There is no point, among the many incomprehensible anomalies of the science of mind, more thrillingly exciting than the fact never, I believe, noticed in the schools that, in our endeavors to recall to memory something long forgotten, we often find ourselves upon the very verge of remembrance, without being able, in the end, to remember. And thus how frequently, in my intense scrutiny of Lygia's eyes, have I felt approaching the full knowledge of their expression, felt it approaching, yet not quite be mine, and so at length entirely depart. And strange, oh strangest mystery of all! I found, in the commonest objects of the universe, a circle of analogies to the expression. I mean to say that, subsequently to the period, when Lygia's beauty passed into my spirit, there dwelling as in a shrine, I derived, from many existences, in the material world, a sentiment such as I felt always aroused within me by her large and luminous orbs. Yet not the more could I define that sentiment, or analyze, or even steadily view it. I recognized it, let me repeat, sometimes in the survey of a rapidly growing vine, in the contemplation of a moth, a butterfly, a chrysalis, a stream of running water. I have felt it in the ocean, in the falling of a meteor. I have felt it in the glances of unusually aged people. And there are one or two stars in heaven, one especially, a star of the sixth magnitude, double unchangeable, to be found near the large star in Lyra, in a telescopic scrutiny, of which I have been made aware of the feeling. I have been filled with it by certain sounds from stringed instruments, and not unfrequently by passages from books. Among innumerable other instances, I well remember something in a volume of Joseph Glanville, which, perhaps merely from its quaintness who shall say, never failed to inspire me with the sentiment. N.D. The will there leaf, which doeth not. Who knoweth the mysteries of the will, with its vigor? For God is but a great will pervading all things by nature of its intentness. Man doth not yield him to the angels, nor unto death utterly, save only through the weakness of his feeble will. Length of years, and subsequent reflection, have enabled me to trace, indeed, some remote connection between this passage in the English moralist, and a portion of the character of Lygia. An intensity in thought, action, or speech, was possibly, in her, a result, or it. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.